We have to make up Parshas Shlach from last week. So we're going to start with that. And what's interesting is that we're now at the longest stretch of the year of Haftorahs in a row that are from storyline. Right? Haftorah can either be from Yehoshua Shoftim Shmuel Malachim, which connects a story in the Nevi'im to a story in the Torah, or it could be from Yishayahu Yirmiyahu Yecheskel and Treasar, which connects some kind of prophetic message, right? The Haftorah of Parshas Noach could plug into a lot of different stories, but there's the main story is the flood, but there is no flood in the Nevi'im. But one Navi mentions Noach, so that's the Haftorah of Noach. All right, so, but it's not a story, it's just a prophet that within the a context of a prophecy, he mentions Noach. So most Haftorahs of the year are from Yishayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yecheskel, and Treasar. More than 65% of Haftorahs come from those four, and less than 35% come from the first four. So to have four in a row is quite a standard deviation. That means Naso was from Sefer Shoftim, and that was about Shimshon, and Baaloscha. Well, I should say that's I don't have to go back that far. Baaloscha is from Zechariah, and Shlach is from of course Yehoshua. Korach this next week is going to be from Sefer Shmuel, and then even Chukas, which is from Sefer Shoftim, the story of Yiftach. Okay, well, the very interesting thing is that of the inspiration Shmos and Vayikra and Bamidbar, Devarim is off the table because all of Sefer Devarim, Haftorah, is only from one book, Yishayahu. But in Sefer, Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, and Bamidbar, has those four books have 18 Haftorahs from Yehoshua Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim. 18 Haftorahs altogether. I told you it's about 35%. Of those 18, right, 13 are from Sefer Malachim. Right, so from the, that's very interesting. Of the storyline Haftorahs in the Torah, most come from Sefer Malachim. 13 from Malachim, and only 5 from Yehoshua Shoftim and Shmuel. And that stands to reason. Malachim is a lot of stories. Okay. All right, enough on that. Let's now get back down to business for Shlach. So I sent out two pages, right? And let's take a look at the first one that has the entire Haftorah on it, right? You see there's a Yehoshua, Perek Aleph, and Bet. And actually, look first at the other one that has the part from the Torah portion, right? Okay, so notice the names of the scouts. I call them scouts. The Gemara in Maseches Sota says, if you look at the names, practically all of them have some kind of hint to Geula, right? Yeshua. Names are amazing. The names all have to do with something about salvation and something hidden, like Vofs, Nachbi, Sodi, Sisur, right? So what they make out, what it comes out together as being like a hidden Yeshua. But they didn't realize that they were never in danger. The scouts in the Torah portion were never in danger. Adarabba, the two spies in the Haftorah were in constant danger. Their lives were in danger at every single moment. Right? Okay, the second thing that I wrote on the parasha part, number two, is Chazaku Mimenu. Right? One of the most unusual types of Al Tikre. The Gemara sometimes says, don't read the word this way, read it that way. And on this pasuk it says, Al Tikre Mimenu Ela Mimenu. Right? See, if the two different ways to read that, either imeno means it's too Chazaku mimenu means it's too strong for us to conquer. Mimeno means it's too strong for him. It's too strong for God, which is very curious. How could they feel that way? They just saw the miracles of God. How could they feel that way? That God wasn't powerful enough? Yeah, they maybe thought that God was powerful in power, more powerful than Paro, but not more powerful than the nations of Canaan, whatever it might be. Another possibility is that the word mimenu, with a dot in the nun as well as the mem, does mean strong, more than him. Without the nun, it means more than us. Okay, that's possible, but there are doubts about that. Okay, after the story of the scouts debacle, the Torah gives a number of mitzvahs. Talks about the libations and the oil that come along with the mincha. It has a little section about a ger bringing the same carbon. It has the mitzvah of challah, right? And I'm skipping a little, and it has the mitzvah of tzitzis. Okay, so I just mentioned this in passing this past Shabbos, that the real problem of the scouts in the desert is that they felt they became so dependent on God for everything that they were getting in the desert. They became so dependent, like children, that they couldn't imagine going into the land of Israel where they would have to deserve these things. So Hashem told them, if you do these three mitzvahs, right, the libations of the oil and the wine, the challah and the tzitzis, then each one will be connected one of the things they got so dependent on in the desert. The be'er, for their refreshment, that's connected the libations. The mun, it's the food, connected the challah. And the tzitzis connected the anonei hakavod that protected them from the elements. So if you wear tzitzis, Hashem will protect us. So Moshe wanted to teach them these specific mitzvahs at this time, to teach them, to get them off the dependency that they became so used to, and to rely on their own zechuyos to deserve these things. But a child gets used to it very, very easily. And a child is a socialist, because you take care of my rent, you take care of my schooling, you take care of my food, you take care of my shelter, you take care of my clothing, right? So from cradle to grave, right? Right, but at some point the child has to grow up and take care of himself. And all of a sudden, they change. Okay, anyway, so Bnei Yisrael got so dependent in the desert that they needed to be shown the way of dependence, of independence. Okay, so what happens in between is that there is a section below Nefesh Lotasuk es kol hamitzvos ha'ele, that if someone violates all these mitzvahs, this is number six, then it speaks about v'hanefesh asher taseh biyad ramah. The Gemara understands these things to refer to Avodah Zarah and Apikorsis. Then there's an eight mekoshesh eitzim, the one who violates Shabbos, and nine tzitzis. But you see what this all these things have in common? Is that this is something that goes to the core of even a dogmatic kind of aveira, where we deny God altogether. So the antidote to all of this, it was a reason so zechartim is called mitzvos Hashem, is to look at the tzitzis and remind ourselves that we have the ability to remember all the mitzvos of the Torah. Now this connects to Yehoshua, and if we would contrast how Yehoshua sends the people and how Moshe sends them, there's some stark contrasts, right? First of all, Moshe sends 12, Yehoshua only sends 2. Okay, fair enough. Moshe was sending for the whole land, Yehoshua was just sending for Yericho. But Yehoshua sends them quietly. It says cheresh. Yehoshua sends scouts quietly. That's the way to send spies. It says anoshim meraglim in the beginning of Perek Bet, right? So, but Moshe never uses the word meraglim. In fact, Moshe uses the word latur et haaretz, to scout the land. They were not spies. You do not announce spies. You send spies secretly. And you tell them, if you get caught, we're going to make believe we never sent you. You don't send congressmen. You don't send politicians. They send heads of tribes. Heads of tribes are full of themselves. They wouldn't make good spies, right? Heads of tribes can be scouts, a fact-finding mission. That's fine. And the information Moshe said to bring back was about that. It was fact-finding, right? That's why Yahushua doesn't tell us the names of the spies. Moshe announces them publicly, okay? Here it says, Lachpor et ha'aretz. See, Pasuk Gimel, Lachpor et kol ha'aretz ba'u. Right? Full disclosure, admittedly, that word does appear in Sefer Devarim, right? But not in Shlach. That's a whole different discussion, and that we'll have to raise at a time where we're doing more Parsha than Haftorah. And the fifth the difference is that they came to great danger in the Haftorah. Their lives were at danger at every moment. And yet they came back successfully to report. And in the Torah reading, their lives were never in danger. It never says that they had any problem. They looked from far, they saw giants, and they felt that, right? But they were psyched out from the very outset. Okay, here they act in great, great might, and they act as warriors, as opposed to the Torah reading where they say, Ephes, we can't do this. That's not really what I want from a spy, all right? Okay, so now the question that remains, and then we'll go to Korach. The question that remains is, how could Moshe fail so miserably? Right? Well, I mean, isn't it obvious that you don't send spies publicly? And isn't it obvious that you don't denounce their names? You don't publicize names. So the answer is, the answer really presents itself. Moshe didn't fail. Moshe's mission was not a spy mission. Moshe's mission was a scouting mission. The scouts turned themselves into spies. They were so full of themselves that they changed their mission. They made their mission to be much more than it was originally supposed to be. Right? Mm-hmm. I'll just say one thing about the contrast between Devarim and Bamidbar. Is that in Devarim, it seems that the people asked Moshe to send this scouting mission. And Moshe spoke to God, who said, okay, listen to them and do it. In the Torah portion, it just seems, right? It says, right, the Bereshim of Moshe Limor, send out these scouts. So how can you reconcile this difference between Devarim, that seems to say that it was initiated by the people, and Bamidbar, which seems to say that this mission was initiated by God? So Rashi cites the Sifrei and the Midrashim that indeed they're both correct. The people initiated the idea, and Moshe went to God and said to God, does this sound like, is this the right thing to do? Moshe wouldn't do this on his own. He asked God if it's worthwhile. And God said, Moshe, I told you at the burning bush, it's a land, Eretz Zavas Chalav Devash. I told you the land is yours. You're going to succeed. But if you think it's a good idea, shlach lecho anoshim. You, Moshe, you do it. I said over this Kli Yakar so many times. The Kli Yakar says that what Hashem, but incidentally, the Kli Yakar offers it's something like 18, 19 or 20 different interpretations of the resolution between Bamidbar and Devarim. Take a look. You just go one after the other. It takes about 5 or 6 pages. And he's one of those 18 is Shlach Lecha Anoshim. Moshe, I'll tell you. You, I imagine, are inclined to send Anoshim, men. I would send women. If you send women, they'll do the best. They'll do a better job. They'll stick to their message. They'll do what the mission was all about, and it'll succeed. But if you send men, I'm worried that they're going to make something out of the mission more than it was supposed to be. So that is that's the Kli Yakar. Okay, Ad Kan, that'll be enough for Shlach. right? So again, this is the Shlach is the first of four Haftorahs that are storyline, and it's only one of three Haftorahs from Sefer Yehoshua. Okay, Yehoshua has Perek Aleph is the Haftorah of Simchas Torah, Perek Bet is the Haftorah of Shlach, and Perek Hey is the Haftorah of the first day of Pesach, because Yehoshua Perek Hey mentions the first year observance of Pesach in Israel. Okay, but Yehoshua, one of eight books, one of about 80 Haftorahs, only gives us three. Okay, I told you it's weighed very heavily towards the latter books of the prophets. Okay.
But God should understand that what they would see in Raglim, it would scare them. It is obvious. You see, you have to expect such a thing. You know what was going on in the land. So it is a very real result of all the
teaching. If I read between the lines of your question, the Shmuel David Lutzato, you've heard of him? Shadal. Very, very extraordinary commentary to the Torah. It's becoming more popular now. It's being translated now by Kodesh Press, the press that did my last book. So he's becoming very popular. His 19th century commentary, and he makes a very compelling point that the 40 years that we ended up spending in the desert was always part of God's plan.
Oh, okay.
That there was no way they could go straight into the land. I must confess, the Ramban makes a compelling point in this week's Parsha against that, but it's a very, very interesting point. If I read that in your words, the Ramban says that had we gone right into Israel, the Canaanite nations were ready to make peace with us. They were very frightened of us. Namogu kol yoshvei Canaan, right? The Canaanites were very, very taken by the miracles they had heard about Egypt, and they were not going to hold out the way they ended up doing. But since we ended up not entering the land immediately, from Rachav we do derive that they still were quite, she tells them in this Haftorah that they were still quite scared from what they had heard. But it's been a long time. So the nations, gathered some of their gumption and strength and chutzpah to fight back. But had we gone right into the land, they would have made peace with us. Right? And our history would have looked very different. Because the only way we could make peace, at least according to Ramban, since this is Ramban's position, the only way we could make peace with them is if they would keep seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach or keep the 613 mitzvahs. Okay, full disclosure, Rashi says that the Canaanites couldn't make peace. Their only choice was to leave or to fight, right? But according to the Ramban, they had a choice to remain in a live in peace with us by just keeping seven mitzvahs for the Noach. It wouldn't require them to keep Shabbos, Kashrus, and all the mitzvahs. If they wanted to, fine, like the Givonim, but they wouldn't have to. And they didn't want to when they became more resolute in their desire to stay with their pagan rituals and practices, right? So, anyway, that's to answer your question, Yaakov. All right, the Haftorah is from one of the four prophets in Tanakh. I think we might have gone over this once in the context of another Haftorah during the year. But this prophet is one of four prophets in Tanakh that the Midrashim say fit when Moshe and Parshas Shoftim told Bnei Yisrael, one day God will appoint a Navi just like me. You should listen to him. You should follow him. You should obey him. So the Gemara asks, who is a Navi like Moshe? So four prophets in Tanakh fit the bill, but none as well as the Haftorah, the one who makes the Haftorah this week. The four prophets who fit the bill are Yehoshua, of course, because Yehoshua takes over after Moshe. You might ask, since this is Parsha Shlach, let's ask, we'll be discussing Shlach too, why isn't Yehoshua known as a Torah personality? Yahushua is known as a military personality. He's a warrior. Right? Yahushua is the first person to get smicha. Right? To our understanding, he's the only person Moshe gave smicha to, at least publicly. So why doesn't Yahushua come down as, like, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu, Yahushua Rabbeinu? Yahushua's bust is on one of the entrances to West Point, right? As the greatest military leader of all time, right? So, well, we don't see Yahushua as a Torah, Yahushua Rabbeinu. So there is a Gemara in Erevin that says that what did Yahushua do to deserve his position of greatness with Moshe? Remember the thing he did? He cleared up the Beis Medrash. He cleared up the benches. He cleared up the books from the tables, right? Usually that's the thing you leave for the porter or some other person. What are you, the Gadol Ador, the Rosh Yeshiva clears the benches and the tables? Who's doing that? Go look in the Ponovitch Yeshiva after Shabbos. They have net Gentiles doing that. No, Yahushua said, I want to do that. I want a Marbitz Torah. But then the Gemara in Tmura says that when Moshe died and God asked Yahushua if he needs anything or if he forgot anything through the mourning of his master, and Yahushua said, no, God, Moshe taught me everything and I remember everything. Right? So you see, it's humility that made Moshe. It was arrogance that broke Yahushua, so to say. Anyway, but Yahushua does not come down as a Torah personality, but Shmuel does. Shmuel is the leading religious leader of Israel. And you know what? He's also the leading spiritual leader of Israel. And I say those are two different things. Moshe was the religious leader of Israel. Aharon was the spiritual leader. Aharon is responsible for the pomp, the ceremony, the inspiration, the events that are meant to inspire people and to make their spine tingle and make them feel all giddy inside about their observances. Moshe is just like a brisker. You know, Moshe's there to tell them, how much wine should be in each cup on Pesach. Aaron is there to tell them what the wine means and how to use the wine to improve your spirits, etc., etc. So Shmuel was both, because there were no Kohanim in Shmuel's time. They were all killed by the Philistines. The Kohen Gadol was killed, right? So Shmuel had to act. Of course, he didn't act as Kohen Gadol, although, fascinating, it does say in Tanakh that he wore an ephod bad. He wore an ephod bad, which in the Torah is the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. Targum fixes it by saying that it was a kardut de boots. It was just a linen coat that his mother made for him, right? So and in Divrei Hayamim, it also says kardut de boots. So you shouldn't make a mistake. Just a trivia question. Who else in Neviim Rishonim, non-Kohen, wears an ephod bad? Who else in Neviim Rishonim, a non-Kohen, wears an ephod bad?
David.
Correct. David HaMelech, when he's dancing in front of the Aron in the Haftar of Shmini, is wearing an ephod bad. And there too, in Divrei Hayamim, it says Me'il Boots. And Targum translates it like the Divrei Yavim pasuk, kardut de boots, as opposed to an ephod bad with a capital E, is a garment that only the Kohen Gadol wears. Okay, so by Shmuel wearing an ephod bad, it gives us a sense that he is acting in much greater capacity, and he needed to, than just as a Levi. He is a direct descendant of Korach. And it says in Divrei Hayamim, it gives the Korach's lineage all the way back to Yaakov. And it goes, Shmuel's descendants, back all the way back to Yaakov, and it goes right through Korach. Right? You see Rashi's all over Parshas Korach, that when he asks, what shtus made Korach think that he would be successful in this endeavor? And Rashi says, because Korach looked to the future and saw that Shmuel was descended from him, and he said, I must be destined for greatness. okay, he was mistaken. His sons did tshuva just at the last moment in time. Okay, so Shmuel acts as religious leader. He is the spiritual leader. He's also the commander of the army. He is the military leader. Moshe really leads from afar. The first battle they fought, you know, okay, they're fighting battles in Egypt, no doubt, but he's fighting with a staff, right? He fights with his hands up in the air, and the people look at him and get inspired. Shmuel actually goes out to battle like Yehoshua. Okay, Yehoshua establishes himself as a military leader in that very first battle. He's the one who goes out and weakens Amalek. Okay? So Shmuel acts in all of these capacities, right? He's military leader, he's quasi-Kohen Gadol, he's religious leader, he's spiritual leader, he's political leader, right? He acts as king. He's the last of the Shoftim, and he's also a Navi. Show me as well-rounded a leader as this. Shofet, Navi, basically acting as king, religious leader, spiritual leader, military leader, quasi-Kohen Gadol. And what do B'nai Yisrael do? They ask him, they don't ask him to be their king, like they did for Gidon and Sefer Shoftim. They ask him, their Shofet, to get us a king to be our Shofet. It's none of the Melech L'Shofteinu, Kechol HaGoyim. We don't have to look for what angered him. Ramban says it very poshut. It says, "Vayera beinei Shmuel kasher sha'al ha'am tzlanon melech l'shofteinu." Not kechol agoyim, l'shofteinu. He didn't say kechol agoyim that angered him. It was l'shofteinu. I'm your shofet. You're telling me appoint a king to be your shofet. What a patch in the face after all he had done for them. Right? In all fairness, they tell him, Shmuel, you're old. He was only 52, according to Chazal. 50, according to Chazal. You're old and your sons are bad. So if you were old and your sons were good, so help Tzaris. You'll rule for 2, 3, 5 years, and then one of your sons will rule after you. But since you're only going to rule a short time because you're so old, and your sons are bad, that's not an eventuality we want. We remember the one person we asked to be king whose son took it upon himself to rule after him, that's Avimelech. That didn't work too well, right? It would have been better had Gidon agreed to be king, right? Okay, the Ran, Ramban's Talmud, the Ran, the famous Drushas Haran, Drusha Yud Aleph, the Ran said that what angered Shmuel was that they said Tznanon HaMelech LaShofteinu, because in the ancient world, it was very popular to ask your king, who should be in the executive branch, to also be your legislative branch. Not so in Israel. Not so. The king is not allowed to serve on the Sanhedrin. Right? Shoftim v'shotrim titein l'cha is a different parsha than Som tosim alecha melech. Right? Okay, the legislative branch, the judicial branch is also different. Right, the legislature is basically the rabbis who interpret the dinim. The judicial branch are the shoftim, and then there's the executive branch. We have these three branches, just like our government does. Okay. All right. So that was the patch in the face to Shmuel, right? Who is the second of these four Nevi'im who are like Moshe? Now there are two psukim in Tanakh that really bring home this point. One is something we say every Friday night, Moshe v'Aharon b'Kohanov, u'Shmuel b'Korei Shmo. The Gemara in the Nedarim says that Shmuel was shakul k'Moshe v'Aharon. Right? Moshe and Aaron was shavim, they were balanced, but Shmuel was like both of them. What are you talking about? Lo kam b'Yisrael k'Moshe od. No, what it means is that Shmuel was the spiritual and the religious leader, the way those two were. Okay? Really, Moshe was supposed to be both. Right? Rashi says so at the burning bush. Moshe was supposed to be the Kohen also. But because he kept on complaining to God and he kept on hemming and hawing about his mission, Rashi, I think, hits it right on the head. He says that Moshe, it's not that Moshe didn't want to be the religious and spiritual leader. Moshe felt bad for his brother. It's only when God said, your brother is coming out to meet you and he's happy for you, that Moshe agreed at the burning bush for his mission. He pushed God back 5 times. Only when Hashem told him that your brother is happy did Moshe agree to go along with it. Moshe says, I don't want to continue the trend from Sefer Bereishis where the younger brother prevails over the older brother. I know my older brother is a good guy. He's probably not going to want to kill me like Esav wanted to kill Yaakov, or Yosef's brothers wanted to kill him, or Cain wanted to kill Hevel, all because someone younger upstaged the older one. Right? I don't think Aaron's going to do that to me. But still, I want to be a mensch. So when God tells Moshe, okay, Moshe, Aaron will be your teammate. He'll be your partner. Then Moshe goes along with it. So Aaron and Moshe serve what Shmuel did himself. Okay, that's two. The other two Nevi'im in Tanakh who are likened unto Moshe are Yirmiyahu.
Eliyahu.
Dafka, not Eliyahu. I would think Eliyahu. He spends 40 days
in the
mountain. He doesn't eat. He doesn't drink. Who could be more like Moshe than that? But I think Chazal turned away from Eliyahu in that story. That's the Torah of Parshas Pinchas coming up.
Right.
That because he complained about Bnei Yisrael. Right? Moshe always defended Bnei Yisrael. The one time where he complained bitterly about them, that's where Rashi says, when Lash speaks Parsha, Moshe says, did I give birth to these people? You want me to carry them like a mother carries a child? Right? So that's, Rashi says that it was for that that Moshe didn't get to go into Israel. But God didn't call him out on it because that was just between God and Moshe. God told Moshe that you don't get to go in when he did something in public. He publicly beat the rock. Right? Okay, So when Eliyahu complains against Bnei Yisrael, Hashem essentially fires him. He says, go replace yourself with Elisha ben Shaphat Navi Tachtecha. I don't need a prophet to complain about Bnei Yisrael. I want a prophet to put my case before the people and to put the people's case before me. I don't need a prophet to spend his time complaining about the people. I know what's going on. Right? So that's why Eliyahu is not in that mix. Yirmiyahu is in that mix because Yirmiyahu, like Moshe, gave prophecy for 40 years. Yirmiyahu, like Moshe, initially objected to his mission on the grounds that he doesn't speak well, right? Moshe says, Lo ish devarim anochi. And in the end, Moshe speaks one of the prose, incredible prose, Sefer Devarim, right? Lo ish devarim anochi. But devarim is Moshe's own words, mipiatzmo. And then Hashem told him to write it down. But he ends up becoming an ish devarim, no doubt. And Yirmiyahu too. Some parts of Yirmiyahu are so incredibly beautifully written. The end of the book is incredible Hebrew. Some of the most beautiful Hebrew of the Tanakh. Full disclosure is that most biblical Hebraists agree that the best written book, is there are the well-written books. It's the Bible, for goodness sakes. But Shmuel, Sefer Shmuel, for the simple beauty of the Hebrew is unmatched in Tanakh, right? So our third Navi that's like Moshe is Yirmiyahu. So far, Yahushua, Shmuel, and Yirmiyahu, right? That's why Sfardim for Parsha Shmos don't read from Yeshayahu like Ashkenazim to connect to what's going to happen to the Egyptians in the future, but Sfardim read Yirmiyahu chapter 1 to connect Yirmiyahu's opening prophecy with Moshe's opening prophecy. Okay, but Ashkenazim feel that since chapter 1 of Yirmiyahu is already one of the Haftorahs of the year, it's the first of the 3 weeks, so Ashkenazim just feel, I don't have to read Yirmiyahu Aleph twice. Okay, who's the fourth Navi that's like Moshe? Is Ezra. Ezra HaSofer. Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Chof Beis, gives a whole litany of comparisons between Ezra and Moshe. Suffice it to say that in the beginning of Sefer Ezra, it says that Ezra was a sofer mahir b'toras Moshe. And it's really because of Ezra that the Torah was not totally forgotten because of the Gaulus. Ezra not only had to teach the Torah to everybody, Ezra had to establish the Torah again. The Torahs fell out of use. Right? This is a Maimar Chazal. I can't deny it. It's a Maimar Chazal. It's a Sifrei in last week's Parsha. And it's also a Sifrei in Parsha's Vizos HaBracha, that Ezra took all the Torahs that he could find, especially those that were in Geniza in the temple, that didn't get burnt. And he, using the Torahs he could find, went by majority to produce what he felt was the Ur Torah, you know, the best Torah. But it fell so much out of use that Ezra, without Ezra, Moshe would have been forgotten. Kiviyachol. Right? So those are our four: Yoshua, Shmuel, Yirmiyahu, Ezra. But only Shmuel has psukim in Tanakh that are juxtaposed to Moshe. One I just told you: Moshe Baron Bachoanav, Ushmuel Bekorei Shmo, Korim Al Hashem Behu Ya'aneim. Right? Shmuel prayed on behalf of Bnei Yisrael like Moshe and Aaron did. And to prove the point, in Yirmiyahu chapter 15, right? God tells Yirmiyahu to stop praying for Bnei Yisrael because I don't want to be convinced to forgive them. They have to be punished. And I want to be a sucker and keep forgiving them. So Yirmiyahu tells God, continues to pray, and then Hashem tells Yirmiyahu a real slap in the face. He tells him, Yirmiyahu, if Moshe and Shmuel would come before me right now to pray, I wouldn't listen. So I'm certainly not going to listen to you. Right? So to hear God, that's chapter 15 of Yirmiyahu. So to hear God tell Yirmiyahu, you know, 500 years after Shmuel lived, if Moshe and Shmuel would get up. So you see that Shmuel is on a pedestal like no others. Okay? So what makes him get the Haftorah of Korach? So I would tell you that it's really one pasuk. Sometimes you get to be a Haftorah because of a whole host of connections. Like, remember Vayera. Vayera's Haftorah is mamish, has every aspect of Parshas, of the Parsha. An elderly couple giving a hope of having children. They finally have a child. The child is almost taken away from them. Right? The child dies. The child is brought back. That's like Yitzchak at the Akedah. Right? There's even a Maisa Stom about the woman who loses her two kids to the creditor. Right? And there's an act of Hachnasas Orchim. The woman invites Elisha into their home. Right? So Vayera is incredible. Every aspect of the Torah reading is in the Haftorah. You don't have to have that. You just need one aspect, right? You just need there's a story of a Nazir. Oh, that's going to be Naso. Fine. Okay? You should know that next week, Chukas, we're not going to read it, but I'm going to discuss it next week because, as you've come to see, I even when we don't read a Haftorah, we do it if it's a double parsha. Right, so next week we're going to do Chukas and Bolak, and the Haftorah of Chukas is incredible. No other Haftorah does this. The Haftorah of Chukas actually quotes the Torah portion. It's about 15 psukim from the Haftorah, is right out of the Torah portion to justify to the Ammonites, while we have the right to be in the land that they once had, even though in the Torah it says that God did not want us to take the land of the Ammonites. Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites, God warned us, that's not your land. I've given Ammon and Moab to the sons of Lot, I've given Edom to the sons of Esav, and it's not for you. Those are the three lands, Chazal tell us, that are never mentioned again, that lands that God told Abraham. You ever hear in the list of seven nations that we're supposed to go into after we left Egypt? You ever hear 10 nations? Right? What are those extra three?
Kadmoni,
and Kani. Kani, Knezi, Kadmoni. All right? That's Ammon, Moab, Edom. Okay? So in next week's Haftorah, Chukas, Yiftach is going to quote right out of the Torah, from the stories in Parshas Chukas, and that's certainly enough to make it to Haftarah. Okay? There's not much else in Parshas Chukas, although it's a rich Parsha, there's a lot in it. There's not much else that you can take from Nevi'im, but this is perfect. Yiftach quotes right out of the Torah portion. Okay? So Haftarah can sometimes, you know, remember we did this in Vayeshev, Amichram b'kesef tzadik ve'avyom b'avur na'alayim, and even Rashi says that's not talking about Yosef and Pshat. It's talking about the miserable, disgusting habit that I actually just met, custom that I just made reference to, of taking children into captivity as credit for a loan. Right? If the creditors would take children as slaves if the parents couldn't pay back debt. It's disgusting. It's despicable. That's what Amos is talking about. That's why Amos says you're going to lose the nation. But Chazal darshnit regarding Yosef, and if you recall way back when, back in November, that I explained that actually the whole entire Haftorah has references to Parshas Vayeshev, and Amos was employing a trick of telling them, you all know Bechiras Yosef, you all know that story was terrible. Well, you're all acting in the same way. Right? Rabbis do that in their drushes today. They take something that's universally understood to be something negative in the Torah or Tanakh story, and then they show how, you know, maybe we're doing something similar. All right. So the Haftorah of Korach really connects to our Torah portion in one pasuk. Now, of course, the entire theme is why I gave you the story of Bnei Yisrael rejecting Shmuel. The entire theme is someone who does so much for us. Karalanu es hayam. Higiz lanu es haslav. Horid lanu es hamon. He's giving us all our food and all our sustenance, and he fights our battles, and he took us out of Egypt, and he made us a nation. And then they punch him in the face again and again and again and again. That's what Israel does to their leaders. What can you do? You sure you want this job? Right? So what they did that to Shmuel. They did it to Moshe, and they did it to Shmuel. The Gemara in Tainus says that Moshe had to sew his pockets so that people couldn't accuse him of stealing their money. The Gemara says in Maseches Sota that men would accuse their wives, I don't want you to be seen in the same room as Moshe. What? That's what happens, right? You have to be above board because they'll accuse you even when you're innocent. So make sure that they have nothing to accuse you of, right? So this is the lot. Okay? It's like when Eldad and Medad weren't chosen as one of the 70 Zakenim, right? So remember Tzipora was saying, oh, you don't, to their wives, to Eldad and Medad's wives, they were related. Chazal say that actually they were step siblings, that Amram was the father of Eldad and Medad with another woman before he met Yocheved. Take a look at the Targum Yonasan. Okay, Tzipora was telling the wives of Eldad and Medad, oh, you should be so thrilled that your husbands weren't chosen. Okay, that's when Miriam got word about, right after that she spoke about Moshe to Aharon. Okay, what connects is, I've been waiting a long time to reveal, is where both Moshe, and it could have been taken right out of the Parsha, right, is that neither of them took travel expenses. That's it. All right. Chamor echad lo nasas, I never took even on a donkey. Moshe says, in the Darim, I could have charged them for travel expenses. Right? I didn't even ask for gas. I didn't even ask for tolls. Right? I didn't say that you should come pick me up and send me an Uber. I made my own way. Right? So Shmuel says the same thing. That same Gemara in Nedarim that says that Shmuel and Moshe were independently wealthy by this time. What was the source of Moshe's great wealth?
The shards.
Sapphire shards.
Yes, the shards from the diamond megalog. They were such precious stone that when Moshe cracked them, God said, "Ah, psolucho, the psolus you can have." Or when Moshe made the new stones and he carved out, you know, they have to carve out some of this, right? So some of the shavings from what he carved out, right, were precious gems. He got to keep that too. Okay? And Shmuel, how do we know that Shmuel was so wealthy? All right, the Gemara makes a drash. This is a few different Gemaras in Shas or Rosh Hashanah, the same Gemara in the Darim. The Gemara there says all this so that Amos and Yonah were extremely wealthy. Four very wealthy prophets. Amos, Yonah, Shmuel, Moshe. Okay? So Shmuel and Moshe were both so wealthy they didn't need to charge any kind of burden upon the community to serve in their capacity. Okay? I just wrote a message to the shul about one of the great Rabbanim in the 18th century who served. He was extremely wealthy. Oh, his name escapes me now. And he served many different communities, but then he moved to Israel. Oh my goodness, why is his name escaping me? But he never drew a salary because he came from a very wealthy family. Maybe one of you, if you're reading my messages, it was a message I sent out about a month ago, and the name just escapes me right now. But look, it's the Nevi'im in the time of the Tanakh were had the chutzpah that, you know, they had great conviction to say what they needed to say because they were inspired by God. Plus, they were not, essentially they were hired by God, not by the people. But they had to have the common courtesy and the common sense to address their audience, even if with fire and brimstone, but in a way that would be heard. Right? You know the Gemara that says, mitzvah lomar davar hanishma. It's a mitzvah to say something that would be heard. Mitzvah shelo lomar davar she'inu nishma. It's not a mitzvah to speak out something, even no matter how much you believe in it, if you know it's not going to be heard, then speak it softly and speak it in a different way. But all right, so, you know, there are some things that the people, the prophets address to. People are very harsh, right? You see some of the speeches that are given by like the Pietzetznerov, right, in the Warsaw Ghetto, and some of the speeches, amazingly, that have survived from drushes that were given by Rabbonim in the Lodger Ghetto and other places like that, and they're so soft spoken, and they're giving the people hope and salvation for another day of survival, right? Okay, but you know, the rabbis today, we have to be very careful because, you know, we're basically hired by a community. You know, there's a saying Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, a rabbi whose congregation never wanted to fire him is not doing his job. If they do fire him, then he's not a mensch. But anyway, I remember I was once giving a shiur on I mentioned this in shul this past week because I was talking about the eminent domain of Chizkiyahu to smash some small houses to make his broad wall through Yerushalayim. You could see a remnant of this archaeological find in the old city. It's hung right through the Rova, and you'll see it's called the Broad Wall. And you see that the wall crashes through a number of small houses. And Yeshayahu in chapter 22 condemns the king, Chizkiyahu, for not relying on God. If you want to build a wall, fine, but don't destroy homes while doing so. So I mentioned an indignation about sometimes in some Jewish communities, you see all over that Jews buy down two or three plots of houses, and then they knock them all down. They destroy three homes and then build a big, big monstrosity in this place. Right? That's wrong. Just buy, you want to build from scratch, fine. But then buy a plot where there's no house that you have to knock down in front of so many Gentile neighbors who watch what the Jews build, buy three homes, each one bigger than the one they live in, and knock them all down. Right? So one of the students in the class says, I don't want to say the neighborhood he lived in, but he says that one of the rabbis where he lives also spoke out against such a practice, and they fired him that night. They called him in Saturday night in for an officer's meeting, and they fired him. They didn't give him like another chance that says, listen, you know, we do this in this neighborhood. That's how we make our big houses, and we're the ones who support your shul. But instead, they just fired him.
Wow.
So B'nai Yisrael essentially fired Shmuel by asking him to get a king. But the fact is that Shmuel shows throughout the story that king answers to him. When the king didn't wait for him 7 days to prosecute the first battle against the Philistines, Shmuel says, you lost your kingdom. We do not win battles through warrior kings. We win battles through prophets. Camelia, I see your hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you that this practice of knocking down houses and then building mansions occurs here also in Kugaran Hills and Forest Hills, not so much, but it's the spillover from the Bukharian community. And it was criticized here by Rabbanim also, and nobody got fired, but I heard about this.
Yes, okay. I didn't want to mention any particular community or any particular, you know, whatever. But
it's true what I'm saying.
I don't want to begrudge anyone from a nice domicile. It's just that you don't have to be in the face of everybody around you. Just build from scratch. That's why it's so much better if you want to do that here in New York. You just knock down a wall between two apartments, and voila, you have your two houses. Right? You don't have to knock down anything. You just break a wall. Right?
Rabbi Shmuel, first of all, Kadosh Baruch Hu defended Moshe all the time. He did not defend any other prophet as much as Moshe. It is absolutely clear from all the writings. Moshe was always defended in a difficult situation by Hashem himself. Who else? Well, no, they were to a great extent up to their own destiny and to their own skills. You see, it looks like that, at least. You see. At least superficially, maybe.
I think your assessment of Moshe is correct, and we understand why. Because Moshe is the extension of God in the Torah.
Right.
He has to be. He has to be because he's giving the Torah. He doesn't get to interpret like other prophets. Hashem shows Yirmiyahu a picture. Now, Moshe, go, Yirmiyahu, go now and interpret it to the people. Maybe Yirmiyahu got it wrong. No. However Yirmiyahu interprets it. He's a prophet. He's paid to do this. That's what he does for a living. So go and interpret it. But Moshe doesn't get that interpretive power. Moshe just fight. Dibar Hashem al Moshe lemor. Lemor. Now tell them like this, because you don't get to interpret the mitzvah. You get to figure out how you want to teach it and teach it best, but you have to write it down exactly as I say it. So that's why Moshe becomes such an extension. Okay, Chever, thank you for allowing me to extend this a little further. I'm sorry we started late. It's a very fast hour for me, and I want to thank you all for listening to these words of Torah. Next week, we're going to be doing two parashas again, Chukas and Balak. So Chukas from Sefer Shoftim and Balak from our friend Micha, right? That's our first Haftorah from Micha. And some have the custom of reading a little bit of Micha as a Haftorah on Shabbos Shuvah. We'll see that later in the year. Okay, so come next week to hear our only representation of Micha, and I'll use that as an opportunity to give you a little background on that wonderful prophet. And we'll have good. Look forward to seeing you next week. Wednesday we have Minchas Chinuch, and have a great week, everybody.
Thank you. Have a great week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Hi, Jenny. Michael, Leon.
Good week, everybody.
Rabbi, Camelia, Charlie, Marshall.
Thank you.
Bailey, Sheila, Leah, Devorah, Yossi. I want to make sure I get everyone, Sue. Hi, Malia.
God got everybody.
Let's see. John.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everyone, be well. Have a great day, a great night.
Rabbi Shmuel, one very small notice. I remember very well when the Jews were taken out of the Gaza Strip, there was a big meeting in Brooklyn, not on this subject, but another subject. Rabbi Shorman of Arskroll came on the podium and started to cry publicly. There were at least 300 people, and said he never heard that the Jews, by other Jews, could be forced out from their houses, and their houses could be destroyed. It is unbelievable. Cry.
Who does more for peace than this nation? And still they have UN commissions for Gaza. And this is what it is. Henry Kissinger said it best, I think. He said, listen, Israel, they're going to condemn you no matter what you do.
Yeah, by all means.
Do what you need to do to get the job done. And don't worry about the condemnation, because they're going to condemn you whatever you try to do. Try to make them love you, they'll condemn you.
That's
what you have to do to survive, they'll condemn you. Walk slowly into the Mediterranean until the last Israeli is kicked into the Mediterranean. They're going to complain you didn't walk fast enough. All right. Be well. Have a good week, everybody. Go to